Vimes stepped outside. The snow had stopped for now. The moon was half hidden by clouds, and the air smelled of frost. When the figure dropped down from the eaves, it was amazed at the way Vimes spun and rushed it bodily against the wall. Vimes looked through a red mist at the moonlit face of Inigo Skimmer. "I'll damn well," he began. "Look down, Your Grace," said Skimmer. Vimes realized he could feel the faintest prick of a knife blade on his stomach. "Look down further," he said. Inigo looked down. He swallowed. Vimes had a knife too. "You really are no gentleman, then," he said. "Make a sudden move, and neither are you," said Vimes. "And now, it appears, we have reached what Sergeant Colon persists in referring to as an imp arse."
"I assure you that I will not kill you," said Inigo.
"I know that," said Vimes. "But will you try?"
"No, I'm here for your protection."
"Vetinari sent you, did he?"
"You know we never divulge the name of—"
"That's true. You people are very honourable," Vimes spat the word, "in that respect." Both men relaxed a little.
"You left me alone, surrounded by enemies," said Inigo, but without much accusation in his tone.
"Why should I care what happens to a bunch of bandits?" said Vimes. "You're an assassin."
"How did you find out?"
"A copper watches the way people walk. The Clatchians say a man's leg is his second face. Did you know that? And that little clerky I'm-so-harmless walk of yours is too good to be true."
"You mean that just from my walk you—"
"No, you didn't catch the orange," said Vimes.
"Come, now."
"No, people either catch or flinch. You saw it wasn't a danger. And when I took your arm, I felt metal under your clothes. Then I just sent the clacks back with your description." He let go of Inigo and walked over to the coach, leaving his back exposed. He took something down from the box and came back and waved it at the man. "I know this is yours," he said. "I pinched it out of your luggage. If I ever catch anyone with one of these in Ankh-Morpork, I will make their life a complete misery, as only a copper knows how. Is that understood?"
"If you ever catch anyone with one of these in Ankh-Morpork, Your Grace, they will still be lucky that the Assassin's Guild didn't find them first. They are on our forbidden list within the city, but we're a long way from Ankh-Morpork now."
Vimes turned the thing over and over in his hands. It looked vaguely like a long-handled hammer, or perhaps a strangely made telescope. What it was, basically, was a spring. That's all a crossbow was, after all. "It's a devil to load," he said. "I nearly ruptured myself cocking it against a rock. You only get one shot."
"But it's the shot no one expects."
Vimes nodded. "You could even conceal this thing down your pants, although the thought of all that coiled power so close would require nerves of steel and other parts of steel too, if it came to that." "This is not a weapon. This is for killing people," he said.
Most weapons are," said Inigo.
"No, they're not. They're so you don't have to kill people. They're for having, for being seen, for warning. This isn't one of those. It's for hiding away until you bring it out and kill people in the dark. And where's that other thing?"
"Your Grace?"
"The palm dagger. Don't try to lie to me." Inigo shrugged. The movement shot something silver out of his sleeve. It was a carefully shaped blade, padded on one side, which slid along the edge of his hand. There was a click from somewhere inside his jacket.
"Good gods," breathed Vimes.
"Do you know how often people have tried to assassinate me, man?"
"Yes, Your Grace, 9 times. The Guild has set your fee at $600,000. The last time an approach was made, no Guild member volunteered."
"Ha!
Incidentally, and very informally, of course, we would appreciate knowing the whereabouts of the body of the Honourable Eustace Bassingley Gore."
Vimes scratched his nose. "Was he the one who tried to poison my shaving cream?"
"Yes, Your Grace."
"Well, unless his body is an extremely strong swimmer, it's still on a ship bound for Gat via Cape Terror," said Vimes. I paid the captain $1,000 not to take the chains off, before Zambingo, too. That'll give it a nice long walk home through the jungles of Klatch, where I'm sure its knowledge of rare poisons will come in very handy. Although not as handy, perhaps, as a knowledge of antidotes.
$1,000?
Well, he had $1,200 on him. I donated the rest to the Sunshine Sanctuary for sick dragons. I got a receipt, by the way. You chaps are keen on receipts, I think.
You stole his money?
Vimes took a deep breath. His voice, when it emerged, was flat calm. I wasn't going to waste any of my own, and he had just tried to kill me. Think of it as an investment, for the good of his health. Of course, if in due course he cares to come and see me, I shall make sure he gets what's coming to him.
I'm astounded, Your Grace. Bassingley Gore was an extremely competent swordsman.
Really? I generally never wait to find out about that sort of thing. Inigo smiled his thin little smile.
And 2 months ago, Sir Richard Liddley was found tied to a fountain in Sator Square, painted pink and with a flag stuck...
I was feeling generous, said Vimes. I'm sorry, I don't play your games.
Assassination is not a game, Your Grace.
It is the way you people play it.
There have to be rules. Otherwise, there would just be anarchy. You have your code, and we have ours.
And you've been sent here to protect me?
I have other skills, but yes.
What makes you think I'll need you?
Well, Your Grace, here they don't have rules.
I've spent most of my life dealing with people who don't have rules.
Yes, of course. But when you kill them, they don't get up again.
I've never killed anyone, said Vimes.
You shot that bandit in the throat.
I was aiming for the shoulder.
Yes, the thing does pull to the left, said Inigo. You mean that you have never tried to kill anyone. I have, on the other hand, and here hesitation may not be an option.
I didn't hesitate, Inigo sighed.
In the Guild, Your Grace, we don't grandstand.
Grandstand?
That business with the cigar?
Oh, you mean when I shut my eyes, and they had to look at the flame in the darkness?
Ah, Inigo hesitated, but they might have shot you there and then.
No, I wasn't a threat, and you heard his voice. I hear that sort of voice a lot. He's not going to shoot people too soon and spoil the fun. I can assume you have not got a contract on me.
That is correct.
And you'd still swear to that?
On my honour as an assassin.
Yes, said Vimes. That's where I hit a difficulty, of course. And I don't know how to put this, Inigo, but you don't act like a typical assassin. Lord this, sir that. The Guild is the school for gentlemen, but you... And God knows I don't mean any offence here, are not exactly...
Inigo touched his forelock. Scholarship boy, sir, he said.
My gods, yes, thought Vimes. You can find your average amateur killers on every street. They're mostly deranged or drunk or some poor woman who's had a hard day and the husband has raised his hand once too often and suddenly 20 years of frustration takes over. Killing a stranger without malice or satisfaction... other than the craftsman's pride in the job well done, is such a rare talent that armies spend months trying to instill it into their young soldiers. Most people will shy away from killing people they haven't been introduced to. The Guild had to have one or two people like Inigo. Didn't some philosophical bastard once say that a government needed butchers as well as shepherds? He indicated the little crossbow. All right, take it, he said. But you can put the word about that if I ever see one on the street, the owner will find it put where the sun does not shine.
Ah, said Inigo, that's the amusingly named place in Lanka, isn't it? It's only about 50 miles from here, I believe.
Rest assured that I can find a short cut.
Gaspode tried blowing in Carrot's ear again.
Time to wake up, he growled.
Carrot opened his eyes, blinked the snow out of them, and then tried to move.
"You just lie still, right?" said Gaspode. "If it helps, try thinking of them as a very heavy eiderdown."
Carrot struggled feebly, The wolves, piled on top of him, shifted position.
"Warming you up a treat," said Gaspode, grinning nervously. "A wolf blanket, see? Of course, you're going to be a bit whiffy for a while, but better to be itchy than dead, eh?"
He scratched an ear industriously with a hind leg. One of the wolves growled at him.
"Sorry, Grubb'll be up in a minute."
"Food?" muttered Carrot.
Angua appeared in Carrot's vision, dressed in a leather shirt and leggings. She stood looking down at him, hands on her hips. To Gaspode's amazement, Carrot actually managed to push himself up on his elbows, dislodging several wolves.
"You were tracking us?" he said.
"No, they were," said Angua. "They thought you were a bloody fool. I heard it on the howl. And they were right. You haven't eaten anything for 3 days. And up here, winter doesn't drop a few hints over a month or so. It turns up in one night. Why were you so stupid?" Gaspode looked around the clearing. Angua had rekindled the fire. Gaspode wouldn't have believed it if he hadn't seen it, but actual wolves had dragged in actual fallen wood for her. And then another had turned up with a small deer, still fat after the autumn. He dribbled at the smell of it roasting. Something human and complicated was going on between Carrot and Angua. It sounded like an argument, but it didn't smell like one. Anyway, recent events all made perfect sense to Gaspode. The female ran away, and the male chased her. That's how it went. Actually, it was usually about 20 males of all sizes, but obviously, Gaspode conceded, things were a bit different for humans. Pretty soon, he reckoned, Carrot would notice the big male wolf sitting by the fire. And then the fur would fly. Humans, eh? Gaspode wasn't sure of his own ancestry. There was some terrier, and a touch of spaniel, and probably someone's leg, and an awful lot of mongrel. But he took it as an article of faith that there was in all dogs a tiny bit of wolf, and his was urgently sending messages that the wolf by the fire was one you didn't even stare directly at. It wasn't that the wolf was obviously vicious. He didn't need to be. Even sitting still, he radiated the assurance of competent power. Gaspode was, if not the victor, then at least the survivor of many a street fight, and as such, he would not have gone against this animal, even if backed up by a couple of lions and a man with an axe. Instead, he sidled over to a female wolf who was watching the fire haughtily.
"Yo, bitch," he said.
"What was that?"
Gaspode reconsidered his strategy.
Hi, foxy, wolf lady," he tried.
A certain lowering of the temperature suggested that this one hadn't worked either.
"Hello, miss," he said hopefully.
Her muzzle turned to point at him. Her eyes narrowed.
"What are you?"
Ice slithered off every syllable.
"Gaspode's the name," barked Gaspode, with insane cheerfulness. "My dog. It's a kind of wolf sort of thing. So, what's your name, then?"
"Go away."
"No offence, men. Here, I heard tell wolves mate for life, right?"
"Well, wish I could."
Gaspode froze as the she-wolf's muzzle snapped an inch from his nose.
"Where I come from, we eat things like you," she said.
Fair enough," muttered Gaspode, backing away. "I don't know. You try to be friendly, and this is what you get."
Nearer the fire, the humans were getting complicated. Gaspode slunk back and lay down.
"You could have told me," Carrot was saying.
"It would have taken too long. You always want to understand things. Anyway, it's none of your business. This is family." Carrot waved a hand towards the wolf.
"He's a relative," he said.
"No, he's a friend." Gaspode's ears waggled. He thought, whoops.
"He's very big for a wolf," said Carrot slowly,
as if filing new information.
"He's a very big wolf," said Angua, shrugging.
"Another werewolf?"
"No,
just a wolf."
"Yes," said Angua sarcastically, "just a wolf."
"And his name is?"
He would not object to being called Gavin.
"Gavin?"
He once ate someone called Gavin.
"What, all of him?"
"Of course not. Just enough to make certain that the man set no more wolf traps." Angua smiled. "Gavin is quite unusual." Carrot looked at the wolf and smiled. He picked up a piece of wood and tossed it gently towards him. The wolf snapped it, dog-like, out of the air.
"I'm sure we'll be friends," he said.
Angus sighed. "Wait." Gaspode, the unheeded spectator, watched as Gavin, without taking his eyes off Carrot, very slowly bit the wood in two.
"Carrot," said Angua sweetly,
"don't do that again. Gavin isn't even in the same clan as these wolves, and he took over the pack without anyone even whining. He's not a dog, and he's a killer, Carrot."
"Oh, don't look like that. I don't mean he pounces on wandering kids or eats up the odd grandmother. I mean that if he thinks a human ought to die, that human is dead. He will always, always fight. He's very uncomplicated like that."
"He's an old friend," said Carrot.
"Yes."
"A friend?"
"Yes."
Angua rolled her eyes and said, in a voice of sing-song sarcasm, "I was out in the woods one day, and I fell into some old pit-trap under the snow, and some wolves found me and would have killed me, but Gavin turned up and faced them down. Don't ask me why. People do things sometimes, so do wolves. End of story."
"Gaspard said wolves and werewolves don't get on," said Carrot patiently.
"He's right. If Gavin wasn't here, they'd have torn me to pieces. I can look like a wolf, but I'm not a wolf. I'm a werewolf. I'm not a human either. I'm a werewolf, get it? You know some of the remarks people make? Well, wolves don't make remarks. They go for the throat. Wolves have got a very good sense of smell. You can't fool it. I can pass for human, but I can't pass for wolf."
"I never thought of it like that. I mean, you would just think that wolves and werewolves—"
"That's how it is," sighed Angua.
"You said this was family," said Carrot, as if working down a mental checklist.
"I meant it's personal. Gavin came all the way into Ankh-Morpork to warn me. He even slept on the timber wagons during the day so that he'd keep moving. Can you imagine how much nerve that took? It's got nothing to do with the watch. It's got nothing to do with you."
Carrot looked around. The snow was falling again, turning into rain above the fire.
"I'm here now."
"Go away. Please, I can sort this out."
"And then you'll come back to Ankh-Morpork afterwards?"
Angua hesitated.
"I think I should stay," said Carrot.
"Look, the city needs you," said Angua. "You know Vimes relies on—"
"I resigned."
For a moment, Gaspard thought he could hear the sound of every settling snowflake.
"Not really."
"Yes."
"And what did old Stoneface say?"
Nothing. He'd already left for Uberwald."
"Vimes is coming to Uberwald?"
"Yes, for the coronation."
"He's got mixed up in this," said Angua.
"Mixed up in what?"
"Oh, my family's been stupid. I'm not quite sure I know everything, but the wolves are worried. When werewolves make trouble, it's the real wolves that always suffer. People'll kill anything with fur."
Angua stared at the fire for a moment and then said with forced brightness,
"So who's been left in charge?"
"I don't know. Fred Colon's got seniority."
"Ha, yes, in his nightmares."
Angua hesitated.
"You've really left?"
"Yes."
"Oh." Gaspard listened to some more snowflakes. "Well, you won't get far by yourselves now," said Angua, standing up. "Rest for another hour, and then we'll be going through the deep forest. Not too much snow there yet. We've got a lot of ground to cover. I hope you can keep up."
At breakfast early next morning, Vimes noticed that the other guests were keeping so far away from him that they were holding on to the walls.
"The men who went out came back around midnight, sir," said Cheery quietly.
"Did they catch anyone?"
Sort of, sir. They found 7 dead bodies."
"7?
"They think some others might have got away, but there's a path up the rocks."
7? "Detritus got one, and I got one, and a couple were wounded, and Inigo got one." Vimes's voice tailed off. He stared at Inigo's skimmer, who was sitting on the other side of the room at a crowded public table. The places around Vimes and Lady Sybil were deserted. Sybil had put this down to deference. The little man was eating soup in a neat little self-contained world among the waving arms and intrusive elbows.
He'd even tucked a napkin under his chin. They were very dead, sir, Cherry whispered.
Well, that was interesting, said Sybil, wiping her mouth delicately. I've never had soup with sausages in it for breakfast before. What is it called, Cherry?
Fat soup, your ladyship, said Cherry.
It means fat soup. We're close to the Schmalzberg fat layers now, and, well, it's nourishing and keeps out the cold.
How very interesting.
Lady Sybil looked at her husband. He hadn't taken his eyes off Inigo. The door opened, and Detritus ducked inside, banging snow off his knuckles.
It's not too bad, he said. They say it would be a good idea to make an early start, sir.
I bet they do, said Vimes, and thought, they don't want someone like me hanging around. There's no knowing who'll die next. Several faces he vaguely recalled from last night were missing now. Presumably, some travellers had started off even earlier, which meant that the news was probably running ahead of him. He'd staggered in, covered in blood and mud, carrying a crossbow, and, do you know, when they went back to look, there were 7 dead men. By the time that sort of story had gone 10 miles, he'd be carrying an axe as well, and make that 30 dead men and a dog. The diplomatic career had certainly got off to a good start, eh? As they got into the coach, he saw the little dart stuck in the front door jamb. It was metallic, with metal fins, and overall had a look of speed, as if, when you touched it, you'd burn your fingers. He walked around to the back of the coach. There was another, much larger arrow high in the woodwork.
"They tried to catch up with you on the upgrade," said Inigo behind him.
"You killed them?"
"Some got away."
"I'm surprised.
I've only got 1 pair of hands, Your Grace."
Vimes glanced up at the inn sign. Crudely painted on the boards was a large red head, complete with trunk and tusks.
"This is the Inn of the 5th Elephant," said Inigo. "You left the law behind when we passed Lanker, Your Grace. Here it's the law. What you keep is what you can. What's yours is what you fight for. The fittest survive."
"Ankh Morpork is pretty lawless too, Mr. Skimmer."
"Ankh Morpork has many laws. It's just that people don't obey them, and that, Your Grace, is quite a different bowl of fat."
They set off in convoy. Detritus sat on the roof of the leading coach, which lacked a door and most of one side. The view was flat and white, a featureless expanse of snow. After a while, they passed a clax tower. Burn marks on one side of the stone base suggested that someone had thought that no news was good news. But the semaphore shutters were clacking and twinkling in the light.
"The whole world is watching," said Vimes.
"But it's never cared," said Skimmer, "up until now, and now it wants to rip the top off the country and take what's underneath."
"Ah," thought Vimes, "our killer clerk does have more than one emotion."
"Ankh Morpork has always tried to get on well with other nations," said Sybil. "Well, these days at least."
"I don't think we exactly try, dear," said Vimes. "It's just that we found that—" "Why are we stopping?" He pulled down the window. "What's happening, Sergeant?"
"Waiting for these dwarfs, sir," the troll called down.
Several 100 dwarfs, 4 abreast, were trotting across the white plain towards them. There was, Vimes thought, something very determined about them.
"Detritus?"
"Yes, sir?"
"Try not to look too troll-like, will you?"
"Trying like hell, sir."
The column was abreast of them before someone barked the command to halt. A dwarf detached himself from the rest and walked over to the coach.
"Tag-good-zuck!" he bellowed.
"Would you like me to take care of this, Your Grace?" said Inigo.
"I'm the damned ambassador," said Vimes, and stepped down.
"Good morning, dwarf," indicating miscreant. "I am Overseer Vimes of the Look."
Lady Sybil heard Inigo give a little groan.
"Kurz-Gurdazak, yad!"
Hang on, I know this one. "I am sure you are a dwarf of no convictions. Let us shake our business, dwarf," indicating miscreant.
"Yes, that will just about do it, I think," said Inigo.
The senior dwarf had gone red in those areas of his face that could be seen behind the hair. The rest of the squad were taking a renewed interest in the coach. The leader took a deep breath.
"Dukraha!"
Cherry dropped down from the coach. Her leather skirt flapped in the wind.
As one dwarf, the column swiveled to stare at her. Their leader went pop-eyed.
Urden, Kura, Dukraga, Ha-ak!
Vimes saw the expression that appeared on Cheery's small, round face. Above him, there was a clunk as Detritus rested the loaded peacemaker on the edge of the coach.
I know dat word, he said to her, he announced to the world. It is not a good word. I do not want to hear dat word again.
Well, this is all very jolly, said Inigo, getting down. And now, if everyone will just relax for a moment, we might get out of here alive. Vimes reached up and carefully pushed the end of Detritus's crossbow towards a less threatening direction. Inigo talked very fast in what seemed to Vimes to be a torrent of perfect dwarfish, although he was sure he heard the occasional He opened his leather case and produced a couple of documents fixed with big waxy seals. These were inspected with considerable suspicion. The dwarf pointed at Cheery and Detritus. Inigo flapped a hand impatiently, the universal symbol for dismissing that which is not important. More papers were examined. Eventually, with more universal body language meaning, I could do something bad to you, but right now it's just too much bother, the dwarf waved Inigo away, gave Vimes a look that suggested that, against all physical evidence, Vimes was beneath him, and strode back to his troops. An order was barked. The dwarf set off again, leaving the road and heading off towards the forest.
Well, that all seems sorted out, said Inigo, getting back into the coach. Miss Littlebottom was a bit of a sticking point, but a dwarf does respect very complicated documents. Something's up. He wouldn't say what it was. He wanted to search the coach.
The hell with that! What for?
Who knows? I persuaded him that we have diplomatic immunity.
And what did you tell him about me?
I tried to convince him that you were a bloody idiot, Your Grace.
Oh, really?
Vimes heard Lady Sybil repress a laugh.
It was necessary, believe me. Street dwarfish wasn't a good idea, Your Grace. But when I pointed out that you were an aristocrat, he...
I am not a... Well, I'm not really a...
Yes, Your Grace. But if you'll be advised by me, a lot of diplomacy lies in appearing to be a lot more stupid than you are. You've made a good start, Your Grace, and now I think we'd better be moving.
I'm glad to see you're being less deferential, Inigo, said Vimes as they got underway again.
Oh, well, Your Grace, I've got to know you better now.
Gaspode had confused recollections of the rest of that night. The pack moved fast, and he realized that most of them were running ahead of Carrot to flatten down the snow. It wasn't flat enough for Gaspode. Eventually, a wolf picked him up by the scruff of the neck and carried him bodily, while making muffled comments about the foul taste. The snow stopped after a while, and there was a slip of moonlight behind the clouds. And all around, near and far, was the howl. Occasionally the pack would stop, in a clearing, or on the crisp white brow of a hill, and join in. Gaspode limped to Angua while the cries went up around them.
"What's this for?"
he said. "Politics," said Angua. "Negotiation. We're crossing territories." Gaspode glanced at Gavin. He hadn't joined in the howl, but sat a little way off, regally dividing his attention between Carrot and the pack.
"He has to ask permission," he said.
"He has to make sure they'll let me through."
"Oh, that's given him problems?"
"None that he can't bite through."
"Oh. Is the owl saying anything about me?"
"Small, horrible, smelly dog."
"Ah, right."
They set off again a few minutes later, down a long, snow-crusted slope in the moonlight towards the forest, and Gaspode saw shadows angling fast across the snowfield towards them. For a moment he was flanked by two packs, the old and the new, and then their original escort dropped away. "So, we've got a new honour guard," he thought, as he ran in the centre of a wall of blurred grey legs. "Wolves we haven't met before. I just hope the howl added doesn't taste nice." Then Carrot fell over in the snow. It was a moment before he pushed himself up again. The wolves circled uncertainly, occasionally glancing at Gavin. Gaspode caught up with Carrot, jumping awkwardly through the snow.
"You're right.
Hard to run.
I don't want to, you know, worry you or anything," whined Gaspode, "but we're not exactly among friends here, know what I mean?
Our Gavin isn't going to win the prize for the wolf with the waggiest tail anywhere.
When did he last sleep? Angua demanded, pushing her way through the wolves.
Dunno, really, said Gaspode. We've been moving pretty fast the last few days.
No sleep, no food, and no proper clothing, snarled Angua.
Idiot!
There was growling and whining from some of the wolves around Gavin. Gaspode sat down by Carrot's head and watched as Angua argued. He couldn't speak pure wolf, and besides, gesture and body language played a far greater part than it did in canine. But you didn't have to be bright to see that things weren't going well. There was definitely a lot of atmosphere in the atmosphere, and Gaspode had a feeling that if things went all pear-shaped in a hurry, one small dog had all the survival chances of a chocolate kettle on a very hot stove. There was a lot of whining and growling. One wolf, Gaspode mentally named him Awkward, was not happy. It looked as though a number of wolves were agreeing with him. One of them bared its teeth at Angua. Then Gavin stood up. He shook some snowflakes off his coat, looked around in an off-hand fashion, and padded towards Awkward. Gaspode felt every hair on his body stand on end. The other wolves crouched back. Gavin ignored them. When he was a few feet from Awkward, he put his head on one side and said, "Hurr." It was almost a pleasant noise, but right down inside Gaspode's bones it bounced a harmonic which said, "At this point we could go two ways. There is the easy way, and that is very easy. You'll never know about the hard way." Awkward held eye contact for a while, and then looked down. Gavin snarled something. Half a dozen of the wolves, led by Angua, loped off towards the forest. They returned 20 minutes later. Angua was human again, at least, Gaspode corrected himself, human-shaped, and the wolves were harnessed to a big dog sled. "Borrowed it from a man in the village over the hill," she said, as it slid to a halt by Carrot.
"Nice of him," said Gaspode, and decided not to pursue the subject. "I'm surprised to see wolves in harness, though."
"Well, this was the easy way," said Angua. "It's odd," Gaspode mused as he lay in the sled alongside the slumbering Carrot. He was so interested when Bum talked about the howl and how it could send messages right up into the mountains. If I was a suspicious dog, I'd wonder if he knew that she'd come back for him if he was really in trouble, if he decided to gamble everything on it. He poked his head out from under the blanket. Snow stung his eyes. Running alongside the sled, only a few feet away from Carrot and glowing silver in the moonlight, was Gavin. "This is me," thought Gaspode, "stuck between the humans and the wolves. It's a dog's life."
Thank you.